For the first time in the history of the IMF, epidemiologists are providing inputs for our macroeconomic projections.
Today, IMF Managing Director Kristalina Georgieva asks two leading epidemiologists what economists should be considering as the coronavirus pandemic runs its course.
In terms of economic policy action in this environment, we still need the macroeconomists, but we also need the epidemiologists to make the right decisions.
Welcome to this podcast produced by the International Monetary Fund. I'm Bruce Edwards. As COVID-19 continues to wreak havoc on economies across the globe, economists are trying to figure out what the best path forward is for countries at different stages of the pandemic. Neil Ferguson and Azra Ghani are both professors of infectious disease epidemiology at Imperial College London and renowned for their mathematical modeling of the spread of infectious diseases. Professors Ghani and Ferguson joined Kristalina Georgieva in a virtual seminar during the IMF World Bank spring meetings.
My job today is to bring the wisdom of two experts to inform what we do at the fund, and it is to steer the world economy through a very, very difficult time. So with this, my very first question is to Professor Ferguson. What is it to be expected? I'm sure this is on everybody's mind. So what are your models telling us about the months ahead?
First of all, we don't have a crystal ball. Models don't substitute for data. What we can see, though, is a picture whereby most high-income countries have now been severely affected by the virus and have adopted broadly similar, but different in details, but broadly similar measures, and have basically all adopted measures to suppress transmission. They brought them in at different stages, so some countries have been worse affected than others. But in many countries, we're seeing cases and deaths plateauing, at least in some countries, coming down. I mean, clearly in places like Korea and China, cases have come right down. In much of the rest of the world, in low and middle income countries, the picture is much more mixed. We clearly know of some countries like Iran, which have suffered major epidemics, have introduced lockdown measures and seem perhaps to be getting on top of the situation. But for many other lower income countries, they're at a much earlier stage of the epidemic. They have decisions to make in the next few days and weeks as to what measures they will adopt. Decisions which have been made in high-income countries may not be suited to all countries. And so there are some complex balances to be struck between feasibility, the health impact of the epidemic, and the economic impact of controls, which will determine what we really see in the next few months.
I am very curious to understand better why it is so difficult to contain this pandemic.
Yes, this pandemic really poses a perfect storm. I have to say, in the past, we would never have thought about, for instance, trying to contain an influenza pandemic spread around the world. Here we're faced with a virus which is more lethal than typical seasonal influenza viruses, but is not as lethal as, for instance, things like SARS or MERS or Ebola. And that makes it particularly difficult to control. Most people who get this infection have a mild disease. Quite a lot have no symptoms at all, and therefore the traditional measures to contain epidemics of contact tracing, isolating people, are much more difficult to implement. But on the other hand, we know that a significant fraction, probably about 1%, of people infected die. So we have a virus which can spread very readily through the population, will infect a high proportion of the population if we do nothing about it, and causes significant deaths. I actually think it's a testament to the world today and our ambition that we are attempting to control the spread of a virus like this. This really hasn't been done in the past. The closest example was in 1918, for instance, some United States cities attempted to control the spread of Spanish influenza, but ended up lifting measures, partly because of their impact, and seeing resurgent second waves. We've now done this same thing at almost a global scale. And countries are now faced with the decision, countries who have introduced lockdowns, how do they return to something more resembling normality, allow economic activity to resume, and yet keep transmission suppressed and avoid the very large numbers of deaths which would otherwise result?
When we think of countries and how they respond, indeed there are huge differences in how they're impacted and what they can do. And actually, I would turn to Professor Ghani. In advanced economies, containment measures are in place. They work. But in some developing countries where people are living in dense urban settings, in urban slums, containment is really not possible. So what can countries that are faced with weaker health systems and very dense urban areas, what could they do?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. In many places, measures that have been brought in, and we've seen in Europe and now North America, are really not going to be possible. And this is because the whole society is structured very, very differently. Clearly, all countries need to try and mitigate as far as possible the consequences of these epidemics, because we know how severe this infection is and how much that will place a huge demand on already overstretched health systems. The focus has been on the health system, and in high-income countries, it's been very much getting ready and providing surge capacity, particularly for intensive care units or mechanical ventilation, and ventilators are a real focus of attention. And I think it's worth remembering that in many of the lower income settings, these facilities are not available, and just purely adding more equipment isn't going to address issues, particularly about trained healthcare worker capacity that would be lacking. What is often forgotten is that for many of the individuals who develop this disease, oxygen provision could actually help their outcome. Oxygen supplies themselves are really quite patchy in many low-income settings, and investments into looking at the provision of as a simpler tools could really help those particular individuals. In terms of then trying to reduce onward spread, it's really a case of doing as much as is possible. It may be that trying to provide, for example, running water in places that don't currently have running water, just a simple hygiene measures could help. And taking into account the fact that we can't just necessarily lock down societies that are dependent on their daily income and welfare.
Well, I am very grateful for this answer, because I do worry that countries that are not yet experiencing the epidemic on a very large scale are trying to follow up what others are doing in China, in Europe, in the United States, and it may not be really applicable for this country. So your analysis and your advice is really very valuable. Protect your most vulnerable people, concentrate on low-cost measures, think of ways in which you raise awareness in society of the necessity to protect yourself, wash your hands. Of course, in some places, even water is not available for this simple protection measure. Try to do all you can, mindful of the capacity of your health system. Very good advice. Thank you. Thank you for it. Let me give you a bit of a sense as to how this is different for people who are dealing with the economic impact of this crisis. It is actually very, very unusual, because it requires economies to stand still. And when they stand still, the normal ways in which we fight an economic crisis by providing stimulus for demand to go up and production to go up simply doesn't work. We actually do not want people to go out and shop, and we do not want people to go and produce. So what we are following in this crisis is three-pronged advice. One, accept that there has to be a bridge built over this standstill period by helping vulnerable households and vulnerable firms to be able to sustain, stay afloat during this period of time. In other words, provide massive support for the economy, for the society in this standing still period. Two, provide massive liquidity so the economic system, the financial system, can continue to function. And this is what central banks have been doing. And three, think early about the way you're going to go towards recovery. What are the right policies so we can move forward? The world has done an incredible job by pouring $8 trillion into fiscal support to households, to workers, to firms. And yet we are not even at the point when we would be mobilizing stimulus to inject in the economy for recovery. And one question that we are asking ourselves, and I need your help to answer it, is how to think about gradual restart, because clearly it is not going to be like switching electricity on and off. What is your advice as epidemiologists, how to go about restart of the economy after this period of forced standstill?
This is the key challenge, that if what we have done, at least in high-income countries, is stop the epidemic in its tracks. But that doesn't make the virus go away. So the challenge we face is if we lift these measures too quickly, we will just get a resurgence of the epidemic, and it could be even worse than the first time. And so we have to find a set of measures which are less disruptive economically, but still maintain control. And there are some tentative examples of countries which seem to be succeeding in that. And obviously there is China. China's restarting its economy now, albeit I realise at a much lower level than a year ago. The other one I would point to is South Korea, which has adopted less invasive, some social distancing clearly, but nowhere near the same sort of lockdown measures as many European countries the United States have adopted. And almost certainly, for those high-income countries, the strategy is going to involve extensive testing, the transmission in the community, contact tracing, isolation. I think the key issue is, what are the range of countries for which that is a suitable solution? Because that will carry its own costs and ongoing economic costs as well. And it's only feasible for certain countries. As my colleague Azraghani was saying, I think other countries may make effectively other decisions to try and mitigate the epidemic, reduce deaths, but not necessarily stop it completely, and therefore in some sense get the epidemic over with in the next few months.
I would just add to that, that I think this nicely illustrates why this is a global problem, and we will only be able to solve it through a global solution.
I know that Professor Ferguson said that even in the Imperial College, you do not have a crystal ball. I was hoping you might have one. We at the IMF are projecting that there could be, after a deep recession, the beginning of recovery towards the second half of the year, especially the last months of the year, and then 2021, a partial recovery of the world economy. As epidemiologists, would you be confident that this may indeed be the course?
I think it will vary by geography. The countries which decide to try and mostly mitigate, but not necessarily stop the pandemic, will see a much higher impact in the short term, but will in some sense put the pandemic behind them. I think most high-income countries and China are on a course whereby they will have to have very substantial controls in place until really we have vaccine, which is not likely until the middle of next year. The extent to which, though, those, let's say in 6 months' time, those control measures are impacting economic activity is much harder to predict, though. I mean, I wouldn't underestimate human ingenuity. You can see it in operation in China now, in terms of being able to resume activity on people earning their livelihoods, but still maintaining control. But it will, I think there will be economic impacts well into next year.
Professor Ferguson, your modeling signaled that debt toll in the United States with no action could reach 1.2 million people. In the United Kingdom, 250,000 could lose their lives. And that played a major role in shaping up the actions we now see. I'm sure you continue with your modeling. And as you do so, is there anything that you see, especially in the developing world, that you want us to zero our attention to?
I'll probably pass you over to my colleague, Professor Ghani, in terms of the developing world. We are getting a much, as Azra said, a much better understanding of really what impact different interventions are having. One of the key questions we have today is what leeway do we have to relax interventions and yet maintain control? Whilst we can't give a definitive answer to that yet, we'll be able to in the next few weeks. And that will, to some extent, shape policies going forward in terms of how much, what's the feasibility of reopening schools and maintaining control. I think there's a different set of questions in low-income settings around perhaps finishing different strategies of the type that you outlined. How feasible is it to really reduce mortality by focusing efforts on the most vulnerable? And again, innovation is required in that context, because it's not necessarily an easy thing to do to achieve physical isolation of the eldest in society, particularly in a low-income setting. But those are the sort of policies which, in those contexts, are most likely to have the largest impact.
Professor Ghani?
Yes, no, I agree. We are actually trying to develop the whole of the modelling framework that's been applied in particular in the UK setting, to make it more generalizable and more applicable, and to indeed support individual countries in lower and middle income settings. Obviously, the same strategies won't necessarily work, but I think these modern tools can be helpful for really trying out and discussing different ideas. And many of those ideas will come from the countries themselves. They know their society, they know how things work, and they have a much better sense of what options are actually feasible. And I think by working with partners and working directly with the country, we'll hopefully be able to support them to find the best local solution.
I am actually very pleased that we have this conversation, and I listen to you. It is reaffirming my conviction that in terms of economic policy action in this environment, we still need the macroeconomists, but we also need the epidemiologists to make the right decisions. Professor Ferguson, you fought and you are fighting the pandemic for all of us, but you also fought coronavirus for yourself. I'm so glad that you won. Any messages that come from your personal experience?
Well, actually, I mean, both Azra Ghani and myself got infected with coronavirus. I think, I mean, the messages are I self-isolated as soon as I had the first signs of a cough, and basically it was isolated for nearly 2 weeks. I think it's about, you know, looking after yourself clearly, but also looking after the community. If we want to slow the spread of this virus, it's important for people who, like me, I didn't have severe illness, was mildly ill, it was not pleasant, but I didn't need medical attention. For those people to behave, you know, responsibly and try to reduce the risk to others.
this is a great way to wrap up our discussion. We need to act as a community, protect yourself and protect everybody else. And that applies also for the economy. Helping each other is the very best way to go through what is, at least in my lifetime, the most dramatic challenge we are faced with. I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for helping my colleagues to formulate projections and policy recommendations. And I count on you to continue with this newly found unity of purpose of epidemiologists and macroeconomists for the well-being of people and the well-being of the world economy. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
That was IMF Managing Director Kristalina Georgieva speaking with Neil Ferguson and Azra Ghani, both professors of epidemiology at Imperial College, London. You can watch the webcast of this virtual seminar that happened during the IMF World Bank Spring Meetings at imf.org. Look for other IMF podcasts wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe if you like what you're hearing and follow us on Twitter at IMF_podcast. Thanks for listening.